Hello, everybody. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. Today is Wednesday, June 26, 2019. And as always, I'd like to begin with a request of my listeners. You know, I'm very behind on my thank you notes to my donors. And if you haven't received one, it's not because I'm not paying attention. I am. And also it's been absolutely chaotic in every, usually bad sense of the term for the last month or so. I desperately need your financial assistance. And I say this really on the grounds today that only full-time professionals, at least as academics, only full-time professionals can do what we need done. My expertise here is second to none. It's not the product, nor could it ever be the product of hobbyism. There is few who do what I do, or can do, or want to do what I do. Our movement has so few academics per capita. You know, average member of the movement. The per capita rate is extremely low. And that brings a lot of phonies, people claiming to have, you know, these qualifications, and even anti-intellectual streak that begins to develop. I don't think people realize how difficult it is to create an argument, whether historical or otherwise. Sometimes people think it's just arranging information under a thesis. I recommend you guys read a list of informal fallacies. And you realize that building an argument is pretty much all academics do. One positive thing about the grad school experience is simply method. And the method is building an argument. The thing about fallacies, what makes them dangerous, is that they sound good. To the untrained eye, fallacious argument seems very, very powerful. Things like false analogies, jumping to conclusion, card stacking, cherry picking. How could you possibly know if someone is selectively using facts if you really don't know the field that well? The information that we are subject to every day is overwhelming. So a high degree of specialization is absolutely essential. And even there, we can't read or understand everything that's happening. Amateurs have a tendency, no matter how well-intentioned, is that they import their familiar language and model onto things that are far outside of it. So, for example, they'll use American terms in dealing with ancient Sparta or Russia. And they don't understand that destroys the historical understanding. They don't really know what a historical understanding is. They know it when they see it, of course. As Edmund Burke used to say, the public often is almost always right when they realize that there's something wrong, but they rarely know what it is in any kind of depth. People who work 8 hours a day, who have normal lives — I don't have a normal life — who have normal lives can't be doing what I'm doing. But the rule of amateurs cannot exist. It will destroy us. Part-timers can't run a movement. People like E. Michael Jones, Michael Hoffman, these are the only people who are corroding the foundations of the Golden Idol and the regime as it stands. The Bolsheviks did not take over Russia with part-timers who worked in an office 5 days a week and then shot policemen on Sundays. History doesn't work that way. And you know I'm willing to suffer. I don't care what happens to me. I've done my part. but I just need to function. You know my record. Many of my listeners know my record. My predictions have come true almost every last one without fail. I was the first to speak of Putin as a nationalist in Russia. I was the first to expose ISIS. I was the first to, that I'm aware of, to reject the so-called Syrian gas attack idea. I'm the only one who's defended the military governments in Latin America systematically. I'm the only one who's ever written an extended defense of the anti-communist government in El Salvador in the 1980s, the first to see the importance of Burma's civil war, the first to see ISIS charade, the first to bring orthodoxy into the mainstream of nationalism. The white emigres in the civil war had a tendency not to learn English and to live in their small little universes. At the same time, Jewish communists were very gregarious, and they had grants of millions of dollars, and they were taking over institutions. I've shown the world that National Socialism is everywhere, especially in the Third World. Most post-colonial governments in the Third World are both nationalist and socialist. My research on the economic success of National Socialist governments since the Third Reich is pathbreaking. I'm one of the first to expose, at least from a nationalist point of view, the corruption in the modern U.S. military. I brought obscure but absolutely brilliant Russian and Ukrainian nationalists to the forefront who would have remained completely obscure otherwise. I was the first to see that we need an entirely new vocabulary because our age, of course, is an intense level of corruption, but the old vocabulary of public and private sectors isn't relevant anymore. That's just a few of the things that I've done over the few years that I've been doing this and what I've brought to nationalism. And I can only do this as a full-time scholar. Therefore, again, I ask you for your financial support. Now, speaking of relatively unique research, of course, something can be relatively unique, like it can be more or less rare. I want to talk about a topic today. It's been covered before, but I want to get into it in more depth. And it's something that nationalists don't talk about almost at all. A long time ago, Michael Hoffman touched on it. But this is the Soviet support for Zionism in the early days of the Israeli state. Before the U.S. supported Zionism in the Middle East, the Soviets supported it. And the myth that the Soviets were anti-Zionist really, like so many other myths, has taken a very long time to die. But of course, given post-war Europe, who's in a better position to finance a country like Israel? I mean, the U.S. or the Soviet Union? But the minute the U.S. eventually came in and supplanted the Soviet Union, what became anti-Zionism in the Soviet Union actually became, or actually was seen as anti-American. It had nothing to do with Jews as such. Stalin was not anti-Zionist. He never was. But that myth comes from the fact that later on, after his death, the USSR became a financier of the Arab states. There's a great article out there I recommend, published by the Wilson Center, called Moscow's Surprise, the Soviet-Israeli Alliance of 1947-1949. And it is riveting. It's really one of the best articles on this topic that I've ever come across. And that Moscow, the Soviet Moscow was, although there were factions, of course, like you had anywhere, it never had anything to do with the Jews. I mean, you had plenty of people like William Forstall, the Secretary of Defense in the U.S. who were opposed to Zionism. This had nothing to do with Jews, however. It had more to do with strategic concerns that Zionism brought up. It was the Arabs, you would think, a colonized people that were the natural constituency of the Soviets. Now, no country was more blatantly imperialist than the Soviet Union. But when it comes to supporting anti-colonial movements, the Soviets always saw that as the thin end of the wedge. Here's from that article, or actually it's not from this article, it's from Hentova's article. On March 2nd, 1942, Chaim Weizmann sent a memorandum to Soviet diplomat Ivan Maisky, pointing out that the massacres and suffering inflicted by the Nazis and European Jewry after the war, most of the Jews arriving in Eastern Europe would have no choice but to emigrate to Palestine. He tried to convince the Soviets that past misunderstanding should not rule out a new orientation of the USSR towards Zionism. He called on Moscow to take an interest in the Zionist solution to the Jewish question. So Chaim Weizmann knew that there was a strong faction of Zionism within the Soviet Union. Ivan Maisky was a Jew, of course, one of the many in Stalin's employ. He was the recipient of this letter. As always, the early Bolsheviks were all from upper-middle-class Jewish merchant families. His real name was John Lekowecki, and he actually was the author of the Sikorsky-Maisky Pact that nullified the Treaty of Peace between Germany and the USSR before Operation Barbarossa. Even though he was arrested very briefly in 1946, he never left the orbit of Joseph Stalin and remained a loyal Stalinist to the end of his life. Now, the way that the Zionists early on approached the Soviet Union, and the way they approached the world, but the Soviets in particular, you had a guy like Chaim Weizmann who already in 1942 claims that there are massacres of Jews by the Nazis. Now, Raoul Hilberg, the so-called dean of Holocaust studies, says that there was no such thing. The massacres, in his mind, occurred only from 1944 to 1945. So he's lying. The same Zionist movement, not so much Zionist, but Jewish nationalist movement was saying long before then that 6 million Jews were killed or at least imprisoned by the Tsar during the so-called pogroms. The Pittsburgh New Jewish Criterion wrote, "The annihilation of the 6 million Jews now congregated in the Russian domain goes on in a well-defined and systematic manner." The New York Tribune wrote, "What the Turks are doing to Armenians is child's play compared to what Russia is doing to 6 million Jews, her own subjects, October 14, 1915. And concerning Germany, in the Jewish Criterion 1939, they write, "Whether our 6 million fellow countrymen live or die, more than 1 million refugees, starving, tortured, fear, dazed, have been dragged from their homes, separated from their families, expelled from their countries. 5 million more await with horror the moment this misery will strike them." And many of you know that I could cite many, many more of these going back, whether it be the late 19th century, all the way up to the 1930s. Of course, there were no persecution of Jews in 1940. The 6 million number is the sacred number. It's not so much the million, it's the six that matters. It's been used incessantly by Jews for at least a century. And what it comes down to is that it proves that the Holocaust was an invention to pressure the Soviets into backing Israel. At the same time, it permitted the Soviets to cover up their own crimes. Now, there were Soviet politicians that were opposed to Zionism. They were a minority. One, of course, a non-Jew, Dekhanozov, who was from Georgia, one of the few non-Jews that was in the early party. He's actually from the Foreign Ministry's Middle East Department. In 1944, he wrote this: "Zionist organizations in Palestine are making every effort to establish links with our missions in the Middle East, reckoning that they will gain support of the USSR for the creation of a Jewish state in Palestine. However, rendering such support will undoubtedly evoke an unfavorable reaction from the Arab population, not only in Palestine, but in all Arab countries. The British, in view of the recent assassination of Lord Mahon in Cairo, Our president disinclined to promise anything that would alter the existing status of Palestine as a mandated territory. We have considerable property interests in Palestine, that of the former Russian government, the Ecclesiastical Mission, the Palestine Society. It should be returned to the Soviet state. Successful resolution of this question can be reached only if the British attitude is favorable, since they are in charge of the property at present. Taking account of this, it would not be in our advantage at present to make any promises of support for the Jews, which the British would take as a move against them. In other words, a hostile move against them. So in that relatively small faction in the Soviet Union that was opposed to Zionism in the 40s, of course, it had nothing to do with Jews. Anti-Semitism was illegal in the Soviet Union. Stalin said many times that he was enforcing that law. Capital punishment was the end result. Liking Jews was the only legal option. But what he's saying here, the problem is that they wanted to avoid irritating the British. The Zionist terrorists had murdered a number of English, high-ranking Englishmen in the area. And of course, beyond that, the question of angering millions of Arabs. But Tikhon Azov is really the only major dissident in what was developing at this time as a very strong pro-Zionist party in Stalinist circles. Contacts between Soviet diplomats and the Zionists continued in Cairo. A writer from the TASS news agency said to a Zionist envoy that they were very impressed with the Zionist collective settlements, even that Russia must find some type of understanding with the Arabs. But knowing their backwardness and your progressiveness, all of our sympathy will be with your experiment. Now, this was the basic view of the Soviets in the 40s, that Jews were obviously advanced socialist people, while the Arabs were mired in feudal superstition. So to piss off millions of Arabs really had no real cause. And of course, he's referring to the kibbutzim. And this suggests that the foundation of Israel, at least in the Soviet world, was socialist. In 1946, Vladimir Yakovlev, the Soviet embassy in Warsaw, received a number of Zionist delegations. His instructions were to give them full support. April 28, 1947, one of the most powerful pro-Zionist speeches ever uttered was done on the floor of the UN. Andrei Gromyko received instructions from Stalin to deliver a speech that would show a unified, firm Soviet position on Zionism. And he says this. He says the Jewish people experienced unparalleled disaster and suffering. He says during the last war, the Jewish people experienced exceptional sorrow and suffering. Without any exaggeration, you could say this sorrow and suffering are indescribable. It's difficult to express them in dry statistics on the Jewish victims of the fascist aggressors. The Jews in territories where the Hitlerites held sway were subject to almost complete physical annihilation. Large numbers of the surviving Jews of Europe were deprived of their countries, their homes, their livelihood. Hundreds of thousands of Jews were wandering about in various countries of Europe in search of shelter, in search of livelihood. A large number of them in camps for displaced persons, and to this day suffering great privations. Can you believe that maudlin garbage? Not, you know, besides the fact that the Soviet Union actually did physically exterminate millions of people from the Civil War onward. But no one was talking about the Holocaust in 1946. This was his approach to the United Nations. This was his speech on the floor of the UN. That Jews in the Third Reich experienced almost complete physical annihilation. Then why did 9 million Jews apply for survivor benefits at the end of the war? Actually, as he's uttering this, that's going on. And it proves that the Holocaust, more than any other consideration, ideologically speaking, was the main focus for Zionist propaganda. There's still people out there who think that the Old Testament has something to do with it. That was never relevant. It never came up. It was never part of the Zionist movement. It was a secular movement. The Middle East would have been picked whether or not there was any connection of the ancient Israelites or not. It was the absolute crossroads of the world. It's the most strategic part of the entire inhabited earth. The Old Testament had absolutely nothing to do with the foundation of Israel, except on the most vague and general way. If anything, it was a way to propagandize certain Protestants into accepting Jews as superior to Christians. But this kind of maudlin special pleading, you could apply it to any number of peoples, especially those the Soviets had displaced and destroyed. And when you read the literature on this topic, they act like Jews are like any other people. But, oh, they have no one to help them. They're wandering around. Oh, they've been slaughtered in huge numbers. I don't know how all these people who are wandering survived it. But, of course, there is no such thing as a helpless Jew. Like it or not, they're the most powerful people in the world then and now. Every major banking firm, with a few exceptions, was Jewish and fanatically dedicated to Zionism. Money poured in to their organizations. But one thing that did differ is that Zionism, which used to be a minority faith prior to the war, now is more and more popular. So Gromyko says finally in his speech why the Soviets had taken so long to put out a position on this issue. Past experience, particularly during World War II, shows that no Western European state was able to provide adequate assistance for the Jewish people in defending its rights and its very existence from the violence of the Hitlerites and their allies. This is an unpleasant fact, but unfortunately, like all other facts, it must be admitted. This explains the aspirations of the Jews to establish their own state. It would be unjust not to take this into consideration and to deny the rights of the Jewish people to realize this aspiration. Understand, this was said on the floor of the UN in 1947. This speech was approved by Stalin, its outlines were written by Stalin, and he was under direct instructions to say these words. But as always, Soviet statements on these kind of things is absolutely idiotic. Outside of the Third Reich, of course, they had immense power. The fact that the Western European states didn't provide adequate assistance, I'm not sure what he means there. Outside of the Reich, they weren't persecuted at all. In fact, they did the persecuting. Now, the connection between the Rothschild Bank in England and the Zionists is very well known. They paid for the land there. They financed, you know, millions of dollars early on, and paid for a lot of this propaganda. What needs to be discussed now is what's the connection between Stalin and the Rothschilds. Some of you may know that Stalin worked very briefly for the Rothschild refinery and storehouse in Georgia as a young man. And Simon Montefiore's Young Stalin, which came out in 2004, the author says this: "The Rothschild managing director, David Landau, regularly contributed to Bolshevik funds, as recorded by the Okhrana, whose agents noted how, when Stalin was running the Baku Party, a Bolshevik clerk in one of the oil companies was not active in operations but concentrated on collecting donations and got money from Landau of the Rothschilds. It's unlikely that Landau met Stalin personally." Now, what does he mean here? Well, what he means is, and usually when you read this on Wikipedia or some academic article, they act like organizing strikes against the Rothschild property is something they didn't want, or that somehow they were opposed to Marxism. This isn't true. The story goes like this. 1917, Azerbaijan gained its independence. As always, oil magnates financed and controlled this new liberal state. During the Russian Civil War, Lenin and Trotsky invaded the oil fields and drove the owners at the time, who was a Nobel brother, out of the area. Now, this drove the price of oil up. And the minute that happened, Trotsky gives over the concession to the Rothschilds. Now, they really didn't have the technicians at the time to run the fields under the Tsars. There were some Russian technicians, but most of these were imported. But somehow, the Rothschilds knew to sell their ownership in these fields in 1912. The minute Trotsky had cleared it out, they were back in. Pennies on the dollar. In other words, Stalin had a long relationship with the Rothschilds, and they were the primary financiers of both Zionism and the Soviets. And they were the financiers and really the owners of Soviet oil concerns in the Caucasus. This is the reason why Stalin shifted in the favor of Zionism. And no one has mentioned that. Anyway, November 29, 1947, USSR voted for partition. That is to say, to create two separate states. There were two options here. Option one was to create a unitary state where Jews and Arabs were somehow supposed to live side by side. Now, prior to the Zionists, they did do that. But now it's a different story. You have these Khazars coming in from Poland who had no connection to the area, secular socialists of various types, very arrogant. So the notion of them living together in the same country was a pipe dream, and everyone knew this. So of those two options, really only partition made any sense. So the vote came up in the UN. Resolution 181 was passed with 33 in favor, 13 against, and 10 abstentions, including, by the way, Yugoslavia. The USSR had numerous votes at the UN because they had Belarus and Ukraine, Poland and Czechoslovakia, which were considered independent countries, which, of course, is nonsensical. But this control over this gave the resolution a two-thirds majority it needed. The U.S. was still wary about it, but of course, Jews are far more powerful than either, and they cooperated as always when it came to the Jews. For example, the U.S. forgave all Soviet debts for the Lend-Lease Act. So, while the Soviets were not a part of the Marshall Plan, and writers will say that's some anti-communist idea, that's nonsense, American aid poured into the Soviet Union under a different plan. The Marshall Plan was a problem because it forced the Soviets to turn over their books. Well, the U.S. elites knew their books. They didn't want to make it public, so the U.S. had a separate plan for this. Stalin's point of view, his connection with the Rothschilds, is very important. But he realized that the support of Jewish Zionism, now a majority faith among Jews, would bring far more benefits than Arab anger would cause. Arabs at the time were poor, disorganized, they had no unifying ideology. He laughed off Arab protests. The USSR would condescendingly lecture the Arabs on their anti-colonial intentions and their need to be more progressive. And even worse than that, they threatened the Arabs by claiming that, you know, any future anti-colonial movement, they're going to need the USSR for assistance, so don't complain too loudly. Well, in 47, Deputy Foreign Minister Gusev, in a meeting with the Egyptian ambassador to Moscow, said that the Soviet Union should, at a minimum, remain neutral on the Zionist question. So in other words, the Egyptians in Moscow said, if you're not going to support our cause, at least don't directly support the Jews. In May of 1948, on the eve of the creation of Israel, the Egyptian ambassador asked Moscow to revert to its previous stand in favor of a united and so-called democratic state. In other words, one country, Jews and Arabs together. Now, of course, the idea was that the Arabs could revolt quickly enough to quash the project. Of course, that was absurd. It would never happen. For the very same reason that Stalin wouldn't support the Arabs, they simply didn't have the money, they didn't have the backing, they didn't have the unity, they didn't have the ideology, they didn't even have the leadership. And the Soviets weren't fooled by this. Soviet ambassador to Lebanon, Daniel Sulod, said the Americans were the main enemy of the Arabs, regardless of what the Soviets have to say about Zionism. So they were trying to deflect attention here. Because the Arabs were up in arms when Gromyko made this horrible statement to the UN. Stalin's newspapers would publish attacks against Arab reactionaries associated with imperial interests. They claimed that these Arabs had close ties with Hitler's Germany and Mussolini's Italy. So any protest against Jewish imperialism for the Stalinist Soviet press was to be a Hitlerite. Now, the U.S. tried to use the pro-Jewish policy of the USSR for its own reasons. Private interests like Aramco's representatives were very confused as to what's going to happen. He was very worried about a lot of these elites, even many of them were Jews, and many of them were very close to Jews. They were afraid of what the Arabs may do if the U.S. was so blatantly in favor of Zionism. So he assured the Arab leaders that Washington's position on this issue is not final. Then he said that, remember, the Jewish state's establishment in Palestine was a product of Soviet activities, and it would eventually turn into a Trojan horse in communist hands, as the Jews in the USSR had a classified agreement. Of course, one of the other things he says is that anybody who supports Zionism is going to end up at war with most of the world at one point. American oil companies at the time were not pro-Zionist, if for no other reason they had to work with the Arabs in order to pump any oil. They were worried that they would shatter the confidence of Arab oil-exporting nations. It's worth saying that the idea of a secret agreement between Jews and the Soviet Union was not insignificant. The point was to promote a negative attitude to the USSR among Arabs and make the Zionists pay more attention to the U.S. and to evade allegations of any pro-Soviet orientation. Now, you read the literature in this field, and it's pretty laughable to hear these guys talk about the U.N. plan, the American plan, the Soviet agenda, as if they had anything to say. The Jewish elite, led by the Rothschild banking clan, was more powerful than them all. So these writers act like this new state being created for Kurds or Laps. No, it's the most powerful group of people in the world. The UN's agenda is completely irrelevant. The Jews will do what is in their interest. They do, however, have to be careful in the Geopolitical Balancing Act. Ella Ehrenberg, the infamous film director that called for the genocide of Germans after the war, was the very manifestation of this point of view. Now, he said, we are sympathetic to the struggle being waged by the Israeli workers. At the same time, every Soviet citizen understands that the problems Israel faces cannot be reduced to the national character of the state. The social structure matters as well. In fact, Ehrenberg was very strongly Zionist, and he supported Israel on behalf of Soviet Jews with one reservation. He wanted the country to be a so-called People's Democratic Republic, independent from the West, from imperialists, and devoid of Zionism. I'm not sure how you can have an Israeli state without Zionism, because Zionism is the Israeli state. This is the kind of mental gymnastics these guys had to go through to make their agenda even remotely coherent on the world stage. But the Arab reaction against Gromyko's speech was very strong. This is one of the statements that was made. We have always fought against Zionist conceptions and have viewed Zionism as an imperialist venture directed by British imperialism in order to create a Trojan horse in the Middle East. Consequently, we have always discredited the historical claims of Zionism as reactionary and did not accept the historical roots of the Jews as realistic. Comrade Gromyko, by his statements, has strengthened Zionist ideology and the Zionist grip over the Jewish masses. Such strengthening will help imperialism to continue to use Jewish masses as instruments in its opposition to the liberation movements in the Arab Middle East. And that is from one of the major Arab communist parties. Arab communist parties were large. When Gromyko made that speech, the UN, the Communist Party headquarters, the Arab Communist Party headquarters in Damascus was burned to the ground. Now, the minute they arrived in Moscow in September of 1948, Israeli diplomats began asking about military aid. The Israeli military attaché, Johann Ratner, discussed training with General Sarayev. He wanted textbooks. He wanted Israeli officers to be able to take advanced courses in the Soviet Union. And in a conversation with Alexei Antonov, which was a Red Army general, suggested officer training courses and actually supplied German equipment that had fallen into Soviet hands to the Israelis. David Ben-Gurion sent a list to Ratner, who submitted it to Ivan Vakulin in Moscow. And they wanted T-34 tanks, 50 fighters, anti-tank and anti-aircraft guns, enough to fight numerous opponents. But Vakulin stated he would transmit the Israeli requests, but emphasized the difficulties due to the UN embargo. And he was worried at the time what violating it might do with relations to the West. And the Israelis knew this was a hard issue to get around. But it would be highly unlikely if there would be any uproar over Soviet aid. The worry about sending weapons there had more to do with concerns about the U.S. offering them a better deal, but even that faded. The Israeli ambassador, Golda Meyerson, stated that there'll be no end of interpretations about the special dimension of the arrangement and alliance between the Soviets and the State of Israel, which has one thing in common. Karl Marx, the socialist and the Jew, an alliance to attack and destroy the world. In other words, it would expose the special relationship. Now understand what I just said here. The Israeli ambassador at the time said that because the Soviets are so absolutely central in financing and founding Israel, Marxism now will be seen, unfortunately, as an ethnic ideology. Karl Marx, the socialist and the Jew, an alliance to attack and destroy the world. That's, you know, she's being sarcastic. That's what people like us will think. This is the reason that Israeli requests for aid were never sent directly to Stalin. The Soviets had just lost millions of men and much of their industrial capacity to the German attacks. To think that Israel will be a priority is ridiculous, especially since the UN was just in a better position to support them. Now, at the Yalta Conference in 1945, Roosevelt asked Stalin directly what he thought of the Zionist movement. And he said, in principle, I support Zionism. There are difficulties with the solution of the Jewish question. Our experiment in Birobidzhan, which I've mentioned in the show before, failed because the Jews prefer to live in cities. Now, I've explained in some detail the real reason why Birobidzhan, I was the first researcher, by the way, to note that the reason it existed was that both the Americans and the Soviets thought, and even 19th century Russia, thought that this is going to be a massive gold mining region. That's why it was there. That's why it was this Jewish republic that Stalin created in the middle of nowhere. It was supposed to be the greatest gold reserve in the world. When it turned out to not be true, the experiment failed. So for Stalin to say something stupid like, well, Jews prefer to live in cities, that's why it failed, that, you know, it's idiotic. Stalin knew the Jews very well. He would never have created this experiment if he knew that. No, what really matters is that the gold that was promised them, the mining concessions, the mine simply didn't produce like it did. There's a small mine there. It was never this massive flood like they'd been promised both by the Americans and numerous expeditions to the area. So that's the reason why the Birobidzhan experiment failed completely. But here you have Stalin explicitly giving his support to Zionism. And his only real problem is that, well, I have my own version of Zionism where we're going to mine all this gold. And of course, by this time, it had failed. That was in the 20s and 30s. But before World War II, the myths of the pogroms brought Jews to the area. This is long before there was, even before the Havar Agreement. The entire Zionist enterprise is based on mythology. The mythology of the pogroms, the mythology of the Holocaust. But in the Zionist world at the time, even prior to the war, Stalin was seen as the patron. And the kibbutzim, even today, you could find portraits of Stalin. They were omnipresent. They weren't removed really until the 1960s. And even there, very reluctantly. So the USA, the Zionists, and the Soviets had completely identical aims. Of course, oil was one of the central concerns. Aramco, of course, the American-Saudi oil concern, there was a certain balance that had to be struck with Saudi elites. Many of them were anti-Zionists. They couldn't run stable oil concessions if millions of Arabs wanted to burn this place to the ground. Now, the notion of this Soviet-sponsored unitary state was a pipe dream. Vyacheslav Molotov, who, as you know, Stalin's chief diplomat between 39 and 49, he was convinced, he was one of the leaders of this Zionist movement within the Soviet Union, was convinced that the USSR should abandon its support for Arab communists because they were too divided and too backwards. It was Zionism that fought the British, not the Arabs. So he had portrayed the Arabs as these rich sheikhs who rule in this feudal form of domination, while the Jews coming in, these Khazars coming in, were progressive socialists. And this is why he said to Stalin, we need to support Zionism 100%. And he was one of the authors of early Soviet support for that movement. Now, the Communist Party of Palestine was large at the time. It had both Arab and Jewish members, and it always supported the notion of one state for two peoples. But because that was linked with the USSR, it also suffered. Even the idea of one state, two peoples, linked with the Soviet Union, suffered. Traditionally, it had close contacts with the Communist Party throughout Palestine, Egypt, Lebanon. But these were now broken because of Stalin's move towards Zionism. Back in 1933, Stalin was an ultra-leftist. Even socialist parties were heretics. And then, very quickly, he moved to the so-called Popular Front idea, where he's going to support liberal, democratic, bourgeois elements in France and Spain and places like this. So he goes back and forth quite a bit, not because he's not a good Marxist, but because he's a politician. But even the Cheka, before the British managed to reach the Jews of Palestine, back in the 20s, the first Jewish self-defense force, the Israel Sarkit, was created by the Cheka captain Lokero with the pseudonym Kozro. They created the very first Jewish so-called self-defense organization in Israel. The Middle East Department of the Foreign Ministry of the USSR created the famous speech by Gromyko that I cited already. It was the termination of the British mandate, of course, the withdrawal of British troops, which was a Zionist view. But the proposal of the Arab countries at the UN wanted to declare the independence of Palestine, and that was rejected by everybody. The British had lost too many men. Their empire was over. The Jews shown that they were absolutely merciless killers. They would do anything from the King David Hotel on down. The British didn't have the stomach for this. And plus, this was a Jewish-ruled country, especially after the defeat of Hitler. Therefore, because the British washed their hands of it, and the United States wasn't all that interested right away, except in the Aramco organization in Saudi Arabia, it ultimately was given over to Stalin. Now, in Truman's case, you had Jewish influence in banking, of course, which was absolutely overwhelming. You did have influential figures in his administration that were opposed to the Jewish state, at the very least because it was seen to harm British interests. Remember, too, even in 1940, between 1944 and 1947, Zionism was growing in strength, but it was still, maybe in certain places, a minority faith. It wasn't the overwhelming power that it is today. So Truman, remember, Truman was very ignorant. He had no education. He sold hats. You know, he didn't understand this. He really gave the decision to Stalin. And the Americans were very struck by the sudden interest of the Soviet Union in Zionism. And the more openly the USSR supported the Zionists, the more American capital got worried. What was the agenda here? There was no causal relation at all there. But the most influential opponents of the Zionists in Washington were two guys, George Marshall, Secretary of State, and as I mentioned, Secretary of Defense James Forrestal. And their only concern was they feared that Arab countries will swing to Russia, and therefore the U.S. would be left without Middle Eastern oil. I should say, without control over Middle Eastern oil. Now, Dean Acheson held talks with Truman, which was, Marshall's first deputy, we would call, undersecretary. And Acheson urged him to oppose Stalin. Now, by opposing Stalin, he meant reject the notion of a Jewish state. Zionism was considered Stalin's project at the time. Now, he wasn't thinking so much about oil in this case, but he hated the notion of Stalin or any other foreign power making himself a bridgehead in the Middle East. I should mention, too, the Dulles brothers also opposed the creation of a Jewish state. John Foster Dulles, and really the CIA, had convinced Truman that chaos ruled over there. And he said, Truman, that the Soviets were looking for any opportunity to strengthen their position in the area. The fear was, even amongst Jews, that the emergence of a Zionist state could deprive America of the oil it needed and also would open the door to Soviet penetration into the Middle East. And really, the only thing that really mattered was the former. And he made an incredibly prophetic statement when he said the U.S. could not possibly be served by having an entire Arab civilization at war with it. Remember, Harry Truman was a Freemason. And like all Freemasons, he was sympathetic towards Jews. However, he was iffy about the Zionist project. Back then, you could be anti-Zionist and not automatically considered, you want to throw Jews in ovens. It was common among many Jews to be anti-Zionist because it was a secular program. But Truman met with Chaim Weizmann, and he praised he was the head of the World Zionist Organization. And Truman said he was a wonderful man, one of the wisest people I've ever met, a true leader, one of a kind. But he asked Weizmann about Soviet Union using the Jewish state to penetrate the region. That shows you how dumb he is. Like the Soviets, the Jews could be used by anybody. No, they do the using. I don't know if he's being ironic or not, but at least he had to ask him, what does this mean for Soviet penetration into the area? Weizmann said, this will not happen. He said, if the Soviets wanted to use Jewish immigration to spread their ideas, they would have done so long ago. And he made the argument, which he knew wasn't true, that those leaving the USSR were refugees from Marxism, not Marxists themselves. Weizmann said that communism can only spread amongst the illiterate and impoverished segments of society. But Truman, because of this reassurance, agreed to the partition, which is another word for Zionism. Now, what he needed to make sure that the vote went his way, he needed the Latin American countries to vote for the partition, or at least abstain. And it says something that the U.S. was ordering these countries around at the time as if they were colonies. But Truman also knew that the diplomatic corps was not necessarily in favor of Zionism at this point. I mean, he would call the State Department on a daily basis, making sure that his orders were being fulfilled. Of course, there's another issue. He was up for election in 1948, and the American Jewish Congress and other groups promised him $2 million if he supported the foundation of Israel. And in fact, not just Weizmann had mentioned this to him, but Baruch, the Minister of Finance under Roosevelt, Morgenthau, and Felix Frankfurter, the Supreme Court Justice. These were the men who had approached Truman saying that if you don't support this, you're going to lose in the next election. The Rothschilds and the Rockefellers were not at war. They were allies. They could be rivals, but even the best of friends can be rivals. Both clans backed Zionism. If any group was iffy about the Jewish state, it had nothing to do with Jews. It had to do with what the Arabs might do. They needed a compliant, peaceful Arab population to pump the oil. Now, there are some people who have theorized that Since Nelson Rockefeller had investments in the very early part of the Third Reich, but very quickly removed it, he went to Rockefeller and the Zionists went to Rockefeller and said, "If you back Israel, we're not going to bring this up." And this is how Truman got the Latin American vote at the UN. They were going to make a big deal that Nelson Rockefeller was a traitor, that he financed Hitler, which is, you know, a myth that still goes on today. It isn't true. Very early on in the 30s, there was some trade banking done with the Third Reich that was very quickly eliminated. Also because Hitler simply didn't need them, didn't want foreign intervention in German life. It's simply not true. Much as I love Anthony Sutton and respect him very much, he's wrong in that respect. But at least early on, the Rockefellers were involved in the early years of Hitler's administration. And the Jews said, "We will plaster this on the front page of every newspaper unless you go to Latin America and make sure every one of these countries votes for partition." So the Latin American bloc counted 19 votes. The European countries only had 9. Remember, this is before decolonization of a lot of Asia and Africa. There's not that many countries in the world at the time. So Ben-Gurion, before the decisive vote, had only 3 days to convince the Latin American delegates and some of the Westerners. And one of the other things he said was, "Well, some of these guys, like Perón in Argentina, are fascists. You guys are a part of this too. We're going to put this on the front page of the paper." He had to convince Nelson Rockefeller to provide these votes. And it shows you the nature of the system at the time, that Rockefeller could promise Latin American votes at the UN, showing that these weren't independent countries at all. I said this in my analysis of the military governments. They said, "We've had enough of this. We're not going to do what you tell us." Military governments in Latin America were anti-American. This is exactly why they came to power. The Banana Republics is what Nelson Rockefeller was able to promise Ben-Gurion at the UN. But Ben-Gurion at least convinced Rockefeller that he had enough evidence that he was a traitor and, you know, this other nonsense. And it was an exceptional move, but he threatened Rockefeller. If Ben-Gurion can threaten a Rockefeller, you know where the power lies. The Rockefellers were of immense power. They didn't control the press. A few days before the General Assembly adopted the partition plan, the U.S. imposed an arms embargo on the Middle East. Now, the funny thing is, that was a very sneaky way of making sure only the Soviets could supply arms to anybody. Now, in January of 48, Forrestal wrote a memorandum, and he analyzed the threat against the U.S. concerning the Arabs. As I said before, this was a tremendous piece of political prophecy. He said, "If you support Zionism, you will be permanently at war with the Arab world." He insisted that Secretary of State Marshall declare an official protest against Truman, because even many Jews considered the zeal of the Zionists to be fraught with a variety of tremendous consequences. Some of the fanatics, they were killers. The King David, the Irgun, the Stern Gang, they were very upset by this. And Zeus didn't want to be associated with this for propaganda purposes. Well, Forrestal was considered an annoying hindrance, the likes of Ben-Gurion and Rothschild, and he had to be removed. Franklin Roosevelt Jr. had approached him on the question. February 3rd, Baruch complained in person and demanded he stop addressing the issue. And Baruch said to him, and this is a quote, "Take care of your own interests, which are now under direct threat." Now, by the way, I'm translating that from the Russian, so that's maybe not exactly what was said. But Baruch was so powerful and so close to the Rothschilds that he frightened the crap out of Forrestal, the Secretary of Defense. And he abandoned the question entirely and didn't speak much about it anymore. Truman, March 19, 1948, had received Weizmann, and Warren Austin, who was the American representative of the Security Council, challenged Truman. And he said the decision on the partition of Palestine is impractical. The U.S. should abandon its policy. His argument was the U.N. should control Palestine and an international body should restore order and then something could happen after that. But Jewish terrorists should not be able to control what happens there. And Truman finds out about it the next day. And Truman loses it. Remember, Truman was an ignoramus in general. He didn't understand international politics. Everything for him was on the personal level. And he wrote in his calendar, he said, "It turns out the State Department revised my policy. I find out about it from the newspapers. Now I look like a liar who can't be trusted." There are always those people in the State Department who wanted to cut my throat. Finally, they succeeded. So he calls Clark Clifford. And he complains and he says, "I promised Weizmann support. Now he considered me a jerk." He actually was harsher than that. But Weizmann understood this wasn't of Truman's making. And he totally trusted the American president. Not to mention, because of the violence, the separation had already taken place. The partition was being done by force. Anyway, the American concern, Soviet concern, UN's concern, this was completely irrelevant. Jews are far more powerful than all of these interests. They had Rothschild backing. They had the backing of every major banking house in the world. And with Hitler defeated, there was no one to stand in their way. And Weizmann, you know, in their typical hyperbole, he says, "This is between the creation of a state and the annihilation of the Jews." So it's one or the other. And it's funny how he mentions the annihilation of the Jews, because on that very day, the Dar es Salaam massacre took place. Menachem Begin's Irgun organization. But even Weizmann was shocked by this. The settlement was cleared out by Irgun and the Stern Gang. At least in that particular village, only 400 Arabs lived there, but they were wiped out. And this was seen as a legitimate act of terror at the time. And Begin says that this is the creation of Israel. He writes in the book, his book, The Revolution. He says, "The slaughter at Dar es Salaam, along with others like it, helped us to clear the territory of 650,000 Arabs. If it weren't for this battle, there would be no Israel." Well, it wasn't a battle. It was a slaughter. So the Jews, no doubt they were reeling from the Holocaust or something like that, and they had to just start slaughtering people. It affected nobody. Again, the Jews didn't need Soviet support or American support. It would be nice, but they never required it. Truman still demanded the partition vote go smoothly. And he confirmed to Weizmann that the new Jewish state would be recognized. The slaughter, a Dar es Salaam, and the terrorist acts elsewhere meant absolutely nothing. And this, of course, is a crime. These are the same people who are talking about self-determination and the Holocaust, and oh my God, we suffered so much, and they slaughter the thousands of Arabs at the time without a peep, a protest from anybody. Well, as far as the Soviets are concerned, the honeymoon didn't last very long. The Jews don't need, I mean, with their banking houses, they automatically control the powers that be. Someone like Stalin was a bit unpredictable because there the state is of such immense power. But Stalin, his primary concern was to expel Britain from this important region and maybe even to take its place. Golda Meir says this, who, by the way, was the first Israeli ambassador to Moscow. She says, "Now I have no doubt that the main advice was the expulsion of England from the Middle East. But in the fall of 47, when debates took place in the UN, it seemed to me the Soviet bloc supported us also because the Russians themselves paid for their victory at a terrible price and therefore deeply sympathizing with the Jews who suffered so badly from the Nazis deserve their state." Again, whenever you guys talk in these maudlin terms, it's propaganda. However, the Soviets had another problem. The big reason why, apart from the financial issues, where the U.S. was in such a much better position to finance the Israelis than the broken Soviet Union, it was the question of the Jewish elite leaving for Israel. They needed people. Well, the elite in the Soviets were almost entirely Jewish. How is this possible? Because the state would collapse if the Jews went to Israel. Now, in Romania, for example, mid-1946, Anna Pauker, who was the, I guess at the time, the unofficial leader of the Romanian Communist Party, gave consent for 50,000 Jews to leave. On the condition, by the way, that they leave their property and their money. I thought there was no property in the communist state, but whatever. The Mossad had to pay a fee for each Jew leaving Romania. However, it was George Udej, who was not Jewish, who was a Communist Party chief, that fought against immigration to Israel. So Pauker and Dej end up fighting over this issue because one was a Jewish nationalist, one was not Jewish. Pauker became one of the most powerful advocates for total unrestricted mass immigration in Palestine, despite the harm it would do to her own party. And the Soviet diplomat, by the way, spoke out against any limitation on Jewish immigration, again, even at their own expense. He says, the question of immigration to the state of Israel is a domestic affair of the state of Israel. Some delegates of the council have argued that this immigration threatens the security of Arab states. I want to point out that, first of all, we don't know of a single instance of incursion into the territory of another state by the armed forces of Israel, except that of self-defense, and they were compelled to repulse attacks in Israeli territory by the armed forces of other states. This was self-defense in the full sense of the word. Now, this is the official Stalinist point of view here. But the creation of Israel had no intention, nor had they ever harmed any Arab state around it. And of course, even though it would harm their parties, these people were interested in unrestricted migration of Jews from Russia and Romania into Israel. Jews in communist countries, and this is something that Rucker says in his very, very famous article, that they would outdo all others in their loyalty to the new regime. In other words, they were such fanatical communists that a lot of them didn't want to go. They were the backbone in Eastern Europe. They were too busy building socialism. Zionism was not an issue for them, not because they didn't care about the state of Israel, but because after the defeat of Hitler, building the Jewish utopia was being done in Eastern Europe, not in the Middle East. Ultimately, only about 100 Jews left the USSR for Israel. Why the heck would they leave? They dominated the highest post. All the stories about Stalin being an anti-Semite were all nonsense. They ran the Soviet Union. They ran Romania. They ran everywhere that mattered. They ignored the massacres at Deryushin, the Lia groups, the Irgun groups. And the Soviet diplomats even went so far in a loud confrontation, April 48, that Israel has no responsibility for the fate of the responsibilities and said it's up to the British to look after them, the Arab countries. I mean, they took the Jewish line so intensely that it made them look absurd. And they even, the Soviets vehemently attacked the plan to provide compensation for the thousands of Arabs displaced by Zionism. Golda Meirson, as I mentioned before, the ambassador to Moscow, says, all my talks with the Russians indicated the absence of any interest in or concern about the fate of the Arab refugees, utter contempt for the progressive forces in the Arab states, and so forth. The Soviets voted against UN Resolution 1943, which would allow Arab refugees wishing to return to their homes to do so or at least be compensated for the loss and damage to their property. Despite the existence of millions of Arabs, and the Communist Party in the Arab world, the Soviets ignored them entirely in favor of the interests of the Jews. So here you have the communists from Romania who are willing to see their party damaged badly to supply manpower to the Soviets. Stalin had written off millions of Arabs for the sake of supporting the Rothschild interests in the area. And the Americans, when they finally came around to support the Soviets, went against so many of their diplomats who said, we're not going to be able to control the oil with these rebellious Arabs. And we're going to be at war with the Arabs for a long time. And if this doesn't show you Jewish power, then nothing will convince you of it. The Soviet Union, the US, the Romanians, communist movements throughout the world went against every self-interest that they had for the sake of backing the Israelis. They were willing to destroy themselves. The very fact that the Soviets were against any compensation for the expelled Arabs. It's a miracle that they were able to come back in and supply Arab regimes. They were extremely unpopular. The communist parties in the Arab world associated with the USSR were viciously attacked at the time. Anyway, I've gone over my time here. I think my point has been made. The Jews don't need to be on anybody's side. There was no American plan. There was no Soviet plan, Romanian plan, UN plan. None of that mattered. It was simply a matter of propaganda. It was simply a matter of making life easy for them. But the Jews are the most powerful people in the world. They were then, especially after the defeat of Hitler, their morale was riding high, and they are now. They aren't just some ordinary group of people. They're not Kurds or something like this. They were never downtrodden. They were never harmed, at least no more than any other group during the war. And no other group was in such a good a position as Jews were, especially in Eastern Europe, where they were running these countries to the point where the Romanian Anna Pelker and others were saying that, well, you're not going to get many to go to Israel because they're building Israel here. Israel was communism in Eastern Europe. That wasn't anti-Zionist. That, in fact, was a different application of Zionism. Israel was a creation of Stalin in a very broad sense. The U.S. were latecomers on the matter, and the only reason they ended up financing the Israelis is that they were in a better financial position. But it was in no one's interest to support the Israelis. No one's interest. Because it would mean an unstable Middle East. It would mean to be constantly at war with the Arab world. And here in 2019, they were absolutely right. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at RadioAryan.com.